Welcome to Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by Community Radio WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill and at weru.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. On today's episode, we explore the concept of craftivism. Craftivism is the intersection of crafting and activism, and contemporary makers began to discover its power in the last 10 years or so. It is a worldwide movement popularized by North Carolinian activist Betsy Greer, who wrote the seminal work on the topic, Craftivism, the Art of Craft and Activism. Does your crafting make the world a better place? Asks Greer. If so, you may be a craftivist. If you knit chemo caps, create blankets for Project Linus, or quilts for seniors in long-term care, you are making your virtual voice heard. Crafting, she says, is an act of agency that empowers the maker to make a difference to others. When our country was in its chaotic beginnings 250 years ago, women utilized the gentle arts of spinning, weaving, and knitting to create homemade clothing in defiance of the British. War protesters of both genders in the 1970s wore handcrafted emblems of their disagreement with the establishment. And in 2017, craft stores reported a huge spike in the sales of craft supplies prior to the protests surrounding the inauguration of Donald Trump, including miles of pink yarn for pussy hats. The Welcome Blanket Project, where crafters were invited to knit or sew blankets for new immigrants or political refugees, the AIDS quilt, and yarn bombing, where public fixtures are wrapped in knit or crochet, are all examples of craftivism. Hidden power can be found in the most unassuming places, says Magda Sayegh, the mother of yarn bombing. What follows are the voices of local Maine craftivists, each extending their individual voice through the quiet power of craft. Welcome, Victor Mazza. I'm so glad that you decided to come on Creative Maine with me. We are talking today about craftivism, which is crafts and activism, and you have a perfect foil for that. I think you are doing the OG craftivism craft, if you will. So I'm really excited to talk to you about your business. You co-own Gallifola Acres and Blood Moon Studio with your wife, Amber, and you are in Searsport. And you're also the designer of the official Searsport tartan. I bet my listeners didn't know there was an official Searsport tartan, but there is, and it's yours. So tell us a little bit about yourself, a little about your background and your journey as a weaver, and how and where did you learn to weave?
Yeah, I started weaving 5-6 years ago, maybe, mostly because it was something I'd always wanted to learn. Every culture around the world has developed weaving in one format or another. And if you look at a lot of the old stories from most of those cultures, spinning and weaving come up constantly as references or how the universe works and how, like, in a lot of cases, it's used as a way to explain magic or a way to explain how the various different divine forces interact with the world. So to me, it's always just been this fascinating moment where the fabric of reality, if you will, I mean, there's another reference right there. So getting to get used to the concept of what is it to make the fabric and to understand those stories a little better and to understand why different fabrics were made in different places. It's the cultural thing that really got me interested in it initially.
So where did that journey start for you?
So I am basically entirely self-taught, with the exception of YouTube, because there's always a cool YouTube channel you can find somewhere. So anytime I ran into something difficult, I would do that until we moved up here. And now when I have questions, I ask Alice at Belfast Fiber Arts or Stone Coast Weaving now that she has the school open. So when I hit something and I'm like, I don't know what to do here, I just call Alice. I'm like, Alice, help. and she's fantastic. She's helped me get over the couple of bumps as I adjust to a new loom. Because for each piece of equipment, there is a learning curve to figure out. So it's been really great.
Tell us about that loom.
So I have a 60-inch AVL production Dobby loom. It's a little on the larger side, but it allows me to make fabric 5 feet wide. And it will take a very long, I mean, not as long as doing it on a non-production loom would be, but it would take a while. But I could do out to like 200 yards of fabric at a time.
Wow.
So it's set up. Yeah, it's set up to be able to like actually put some level of production power in your hands, which is really kind of what we need for where we're at in our store journey and in our business journey. So it's really fantastic. And I enjoy working on it. I'm still working out some of the kinks in the process because I'm not used to one this wide or this complicated.
Well, you have the mind of an engineer, I think, and so you'll figure it out, I'm sure. You have designed and woven an, quote, official tartan. So can you explain what a tartan is, how tartans are devised and adopted by those who do, and a little of their history? What were they originally for?
Some of the history bit gets a little murky because there are lots of different stories about where tartan came from and how it came to be. I think the best place to start is kind of with what tartan is. And there's actually an official legal definition of tartan from the Scottish Register of Tartans Act in 2008. And what that act did was establish the official registry, but it also took the time to define tartan. So tartan is a design which is capable of being woven and consists of two or more alternating colored stripes, which combine vertically and horizontally to form a repeated checked pattern. The pattern is traditionally known as the set of the tartan. Okay. The sequence of warp colors, long ways, or vertical threads is repeated in the same order and size in the weft, or your crossways or horizontal threads. And where a warp stripe crosses a weft stripe of the same color, this results in a block of solid color. Where it crosses one color and another color, the result is an equal mixture of the two, which is referred to as a half tone. It does go on to further say that traditionally tartans are woven in a 2-2 staggered twill, which is what gives it the familiar diagonal hatching appearance. However, it doesn't have to be woven in the 2-2 twill. Most of them still are. And most tartans are also considered symmetrical tartans. However, you can have an asymmetric pattern. The best way I can describe the difference is a symmetric pattern. There comes a point in the thread count where you start working the other way. Like you just take a mirror and you put it on there and you fold it over. And that's how you get the whole set. A non-symmetrical set, you can't do that at any point in the tartan. You can't drop a mirror in and see on both sides of the glass, having it be the same. So most tartan is symmetrical. There are some asymmetrical ones.
Okay. Why did Scotland feel that it had to have an official register? What do these tartan patterns and sets represent?
So more modernly, a lot of the tartans are connected to families or to locations or towns or districts. So in Ireland, your tartan is the county that you're from. In Scotland, the tartan, it ties back to your clan. Lots of people also use it for corporate identification because its biggest role in history and moving forward is actually an identifier. It's to show that you belong. And that's how historically it's been used for the longest time. When you start to see all of the different tartans, some of what you run into is corporate tartans, for example, are traditionally, or I shouldn't say traditionally, corporate tartans are typically registered restricted, meaning that the corporation can control who weaves it, who wears it, things like that. Mm-hmm. Because you have to work for the corporation to be allowed to wear the tartan. Okay. There are military units that have them as well, and then it's like part of an issue uniform at that point.
Tartans are worn by the Scottish military, am I right? For dress purposes?
Large chunks. I don't know that every regiment necessarily has its own, but there are lots of regiments that have their own. The thing that you run into there is, like I said, you have all the different kind of like this is this group of people. And so some of them are registered restricted, and then others are registered unrestricted, which means anybody can weave it, anybody can wear it, mm-hmm. Which is what we did with the Searsport tartan, because it's meant as a gift for the community. Because there's a lot of Celtic heritage in the area, but not everybody has Celtic heritage or is in touch with their Celtic heritage. But there's the Belfast Celtic Festival. There's Highland Games up here every year. So what we did is we took and we did a lot of research working with the Historic Preservation Commission and the Historic Society and the Maritime Museum, the Penobscot Bay Marine Museum. To look at the founding families when Searsport was founded and to go through and to figure out who had Celtic heritage. And then to narrow it down, we looked at all of the families that were specifically involved in the sea trade, whether that was ship's captains or shipyards or chandlers or rope walks or any of the necessary trades for outfitting and sailing ships. Because at one point, a little more than one out of three sea captains in the country sailed out of Searsport. No, actually, it's one out of 10. It's one out of 10. Sorry.
It's still an incredible statistic.
33 out of like 300 blue water captains at the time sailed out of Searsport and called it home. So that's kind of where we started with the narrowing it down, is it's like, all right, well, let's go down the list of everybody who was involved in the sea trade, because that was the economy of Searsport when it was founded. Mm-hmm. And we identified 16 families that had Celtic heritage and would wear a tartan, or would be entitled to wear a tartan. And what we did is the same process that you run into when a new clan would be founded. You would take the tartans of the people who were involved in the founding the new clan, and you would blend them together into one tartan. So that's what we did for Searsport, is we took the tartans of all of the families that we had identified and blended it out into one tartan. So the colors that are there are actually colors that were present when the town was founded. The colors and the thread count and like the actual patterning was taken from tartans that would have been here on the street the day the town was founded.
That's great. That's amazing. So that's what it symbolizes. Mm-hmm. But I know that tartans were and sometimes are used as symbols of resistance and protest. So can you give us a little of that background?
Yeah, so the biggest moment in history, if you will, that tartans were really seen as a protest gets into some of the history after the Jacobite Rebellion in the UK, where the Highland clans all supported the rebellion, and those were the people who predominantly wore tartan. And after the rebellion failed, the British Crown said, you know what, tartan's illegal now. And in that moment, these people were told, hey, your identities don't matter. Your clans don't matter. Your people don't matter. Your history doesn't matter. And that's kind of a lot to swallow for anybody, really.
Well, we have some of that echoed in the present day. So that's why it's so interesting.
And then it became a symbol of the resistance to British rule, because it wasn't just, oh, you know, this is who I've always been. It's in a lot of cases, there were very extreme penalties set by those laws for people found in possession of tartan. Bagpipes were also among the things that were listed and prescribed So you find a lot of these things that became symbols of resistance, or resistance purely because people refused to give up their identity. And rightfully so.
Yeah, like,
there's no point in history where you can look at anybody and go, hey, your history doesn't matter, and not expect them to be like, yeah, actually, it does. But that's kind of where the initial burst of tartan being a symbol of resistance came from. But the other thing I think that makes it a symbol of resistance is because it's also a symbol of identity. So it's something that people can use to identify. It's like, in a lot of ways, there are flags for nations or causes or, you know, things like that. It's kind of the same thing in a lot of ways. It's just, here's something that we identify with and let it lead us forward. And it's the same thing with tartan.
Fascinating. So you and Amber don't only make tartans. You have a business in Searsport that is a fiber arts-based business. Can you tell us a little bit about it? It's called Blood Moon Studio, and
yeah,
it's on Main Street in Searsport.
Yeah, we sell every step of the fiber journey, from raw fleece all the way out to finished fabric in some instances, and the tools to get you there. No matter what stage of the process you're interested in, no matter where you're at in your journey, that's what we look to provide, is the ability for you to find your craft and hone your craft. We do spinning, weaving, felting, knitting, crochet, lace making, basically the whole thing. If there's
you dye some of those fibers yourself, right?
Yeah, we do carry our own hand dyed. We also carry lots of local farm yarn. We have 3 farms on the shelf right now. We have the Buyer at Piper's Pond, and then we have Farm on Empire and Ingdahl Acres, which are the 3 local farms we're carrying right now. And then we have Freshwater Pearl Fibers is working up a dye lot specifically for our store that she's going to bring in. And that's kind of one of the biggest things for us, is we like to support local. We like to give local artisans a market that they can take their goods to and not have to pay crazy prices on to get their goods sold. Most people who are farming fiber are already on really thin margins anyway.
Yeah, I would think so.
So we try to take very, very little in commission in comparison with lots of other places. It's part of why we started the store, is because we didn't like the commission rates we were seeing when we were looking for somewhere to sell our yarn. So we try and kind of encourage local artisans. We do also carry other yarns and other fibers as well. I'm actually super excited. Tomorrow we're going to go pick up heather. I don't know if you're familiar with the Jagerspun yarn lines.
Yes, I've knit a couple sweaters out of it. Yes.
The company that is picking up the production of their yarn lines, we're going to go drive down and meet them and pick up about 70 pounds of heather tomorrow to put into the store. So we're very excited.
There are a lot of adherents from Jagerspun who are going to be really happy to hear that.
They're wonderful people. I got to get to know them while I was taking the equipment apart down there to bring up here.
Yeah, we didn't even get into that discussion, but you're hoping to put some of that back together as a new yarn mill.
That's actually why we started the store, was to raise funding to put the building in. That way we could bring some of the equipment back online here in town. Yeah.
That's amazing. So how can our Creative Maine listeners find you and Blood Moon Studio and take advantage of all the great stuff you have?
We do have a website. You can also just Google Blood Moon Studio Market. It'll pop right up and take you to it. Or our farm name is Gallifolo, which is in Gaelic, which of course makes it fun to spell. But it's G-E-A-L-A-C-H space F-O-L-A. And if you Google that, we'll pop up really quick too. We're at 428 East Main Street in Searsport. We're open by appointment. We're also open Thursday, Friday, Saturday right now from 11 to 5. We have a crafting meetup on Saturdays from 2 to 4. Where you just basically bring whatever your craft is and you come make in community. And those are the easiest ways to get a hold of us. One of the things that we are very excited about is we are doing Searsport tartan keychains right now, is what I currently have on production. But once I get through that, I have a bunch more tartan to weave up. We're opening up to doing custom design work, custom weaving work, and to helping people do the registration process as well, or doing the registration process for a fee. But we're going to open up the tartan side of the house a bit more in the coming years. That way
That's
people
amazing.
Can put their own design and get it woven.
Is there a picture of the tartan on your website somewhere?
There is. Our website's a little under construction, so bear with us if you get to it.
Okay.
But there is a tab. It's Searsport Tartan Project. If you find it on there, that's what it's under right now. And it has the thread count and the colors and kind of a bit more of the story of it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Vic Mazza. I'm very excited to have you. It was a very interesting discussion. I'm sure we all learned a thing or two. So thank you.
Well, thank you,
and we'll hope to talk with you again.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavors. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around the region. Thursday, March 26th at 7:30 p.m., the University of Maine School of Performing Arts presents trombone quartet The Bare Bones in Minsky Recital Hall. Admission is free, and the concert may be accessed through live stream on the SPA YouTube channel. For more information, visit umaine.edu/las/School of Performing Arts. On the second and fourth Saturdays of the month, from 9:30 to 11, Waterfall Arts at 256 High Street in Belfast hosts Stitch Social, an opportunity to bring a project to work on in friendly community. No reservations are needed. For further information, contact Amy Tingle at Waterfall Arts, 207-338-2222, or visit waterfallarts.org. Join other knitters for a day of knitting, crafting, noshing, and camaraderie. Saturday, March 28th at 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. in St. Margaret's Parish Hall, 95 Court Street, Belfast. Contributions will go to the Midcoast Maine Homeless Coalition. For more information, call St. Margaret's Episcopal Church at 207-338-2412. For a more complete listing of events, visit our website, weru.org, and click the Community Calendar tab. If you would like to add an item to the community calendar, you may follow the prompts on the calendar page and submit your own event for the list. If you have an event that you feel is particularly pertinent to Creative Maine, send a note with the details to info@weru.org and list Creative Maine in the subject line. You are listening to Creative Maine on WERU 89.9 FM and on weru.org. Next, we hear about the crafting voice of Connie Whitaker. Welcome, Connie Whitaker, to Creative Maine. I'm so glad that you consented to come on with me and talk a little bit about this phenomenon known as craftivism and the practice of craftivism, which I have mentioned in my intro, is the intersection of craft and activism. It has spanned many centuries, taken many forms, but you have employed your very personal creativity to extend your beliefs and your voice. And I would like to know what your definition of craftivism is and what you understand and believe its impacts to be.
I think for me, craftivism is voicing your opinions through your craft, making connections with other people, in some ways pulling from the manifesto and stuff from Tal Fitzpatrick and Betsy Greer, but it's making connections, bearing witness, making a difference, kind of being a spark, maybe, perhaps, hopefully, for change and conversation.
Yeah, a spark, that's a good way to put it, because you're people look at what you do and pause for a second and say, oh, yeah. And you know, it's food for thought for sure. What are your particular craft or crafts that you use to spark these thoughts and conversations and messages? What do you do?
Mostly it's textile art and fiber. I weave and I spin, I embroider. A lot of what I do that has my voice or my message comes from things that I've done mainly to calm myself through this crazy, chaotic, frenetic world we seem to be living in now.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my embroidery started during the pandemic when I started making a scrap coat. I think it was like my third or my fourth one, but I needed something to sew on. So I still had scraps. So I started making the coat. And when I finished putting the coat together, I needed something still. So I started embroidering it. And it started out with, it was during Black Lives Matter. And I started embroidering initials with a circle in black, just making wider and wider circles around each set of initials for like the ripples in a pond.
Oh, yeah.
And then since there was COVID, I did the same thing. I just started with concentric circles, embroidering red circles around and around. And those were overlapping the black circles. And then we had so much white supremacy and stuff happening. I started doing like a web stitch, a blanket stitch into like a web shape over top of everything that was happening in white. And then using signature color, I started also doing that in orange on top of the white and the red and the black. And the coat is quite covered. And I finally called it done in 2023, I think, or 2024. And then this last year in 2025, in January or the end of January and February, I started another coat. This one was just supposed to, again, take up time. And it was using all the scrap threads and fibers and stuff in my studio that got overlaid with some tulle net fabric to hold all the scraps and stitches in place. And then I was going to embroider over top. But then I don't know if you're familiar with Tiny Pricks. I forgot her name. Makes me mad.
That's okay. I can look that up. But what is it? Is it?
Yeah, she embroiders on linens, handkerchiefs, and things like that. And it's usually a quote or something someone has said. And she did that, I think, during most of Trump's first presidency. So when I started this coat, I think it was when Ukraine got bombed by Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I started just embroidering in blues for the Ukrainian flag. And the coat, it's basically a worry coat. Anything that pops in my head, I get it out onto the coat. And it's covered now. It's quite heavy. And I named it when we put it in an exhibition for Stitch Social. We had an exhibit this last fall, summer. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's called The Weight I Carry. It's like putting it onto the coat gets it out of my head. And also, I planned on wearing it, which is hard because it's having my inside thoughts on my outside.
Well, I know you're wearing your coat number one.
Yeah. For an introvert, it's a very interesting experience.
Do you get approached? Do you get questioned about what's on your coat?
Not so much by that one, out by strangers. I have another coat that I wear that has something I embroidered on the back of it. It remove corrupt politicians, reclaim our democracy, restore, I forget the last word. Anyway, people have come up to me and say, I want to read that. And they read it. And then I've gotten pats on the back and thumbs up and just thank you. I haven't had anybody ever say anything to me that was negative.
Nobody's tried to to deal you a right cross or anything.
But it feels like wearing a target on my back. The coat that you saw today that's really covered in stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Other than friends and acquaintances, no one has ever asked if they could read it. I think it just kind of takes them aback.
Well, I think something that overlaid with symbolism and messages. There's a lot of messages. It's not a message. Mm-hmm. And I think that that maybe takes people by surprise. They're not ready to react to it when they see it. And it takes a great deal of bravery for you to do that, in my opinion.
Yes, it does.
Well, good for you. So what's some of your background? Where did you didn't always live in embroidery world in Belfast. So where did you come from? What were some of your background training and experiences that brought you to this point and to these messages? I mean, I know why you have the messages.
Right. We all know why we're at this point, but how did we get here? And personally, I come from a military family. My father was in the Army. I've lived all over, lived in Panama Canal Zone for 5.5 years. We lived in Germany. I've lived in Louisiana and Illinois, and my dad retired in San Antonio, Texas. Mm-hmm. My mother was a home ec teacher for a little bit of time that she was allowed to teach because she had five daughters. So she did teach us how to sew and how to cook and things that I love to do. So I'm eternally grateful for that. And I've always liked doing stuff with my hands. I started out mostly in pottery, but as far as work goes, I've done all kinds of things. I was a secretary. I went to school when my son was in kindergarten and got my bachelor's degree in arts. I taught school briefly, but I didn't want to teach out of district. And I 1 year was enough to teach me that I don't deal well with bureaucracy.
And there's plenty of that in the public school system.
Yeah. And at the time, it was easier for me to basically, I built a childcare center and there was less bureaucracy in childcare at the time. And I was all for standards and everything. But eventually, after 15 years, the changes that had happened in kids, in families, in schools, that was what years were those. I started in 1996 and ended in 2010.
Mm-hmm. Well, but in the 2003, you had, or four, whatever, you had the No Child Left Behind. And that's mm-hmm. when education started to be not fun.
It was felt like more and more kids were being left behind than before. Mm-hmm. And if they weren't being left behind, they were being shoved, whether they were ready or not. In a very unhealthy way. Mm-hmm. So that was just, it wasn't not just fun anymore. It's just, I just take on everybody's stress and I could feel it and it was horrid. So I quit that and I opened a community pottery studio and didn't ever dream that I would actually sell stuff, but I started selling things in craft fairs and that got to be not fun anymore because it was always, I know he didn't mean to do that, but for my husband, validation was when I sold something.
Oh, no.
And yes. And what that meant was I now have bins of pottery that I don't like that never sold because it doesn't have my confidence in it because I don't care about it.
It doesn't have the same soul that other things have.
Exactly. I was going to say that soul, but it feels like it's seemed cliche. But yes, it doesn't have my soul in it. And really creativity on it. So, and then when I didn't have a clay studio, I ended up back in my sewing room. And then I've been eco dyeing and eco printing and knitting, and I've learned to spin. And it's just one craft leads to another.
It does. It does. So you're a member of Stitch Social, which is a group that I visited this morning, and we'll hear some more from some of the members of Stitch Social later in the program, but it's based in Belfast at the Waterfall Arts Building. So how does this group that you're in aid and abet the work of its various members? Do you feel that the group as a whole has a specific set of messages, or are there different voices and points of view inherent in the crafting of the individuals in the group?
The group has no message, I don't think, or goals or anything other than it's a place to meet and sit and stitch and be together. I've lived in Belfast now over a year and a half, and I wanted definitely was sure I needed to live in a place that had a group like that. But this was one of the first times where, again, as an introvert, I forced myself to go to the first time because I was going by myself because I didn't know anybody. But when I got there, it was like someone had been holding my chair for me all this time.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very comfortable. And we all have, I don't know how this happened. It's, I guess, like attracts like, and we all have very similar viewpoints and concerns. And it's just a very warm, loving group. Yes. And if you want to know how to do something, ask somebody. It's very good at finding resources. If there's no one there that can help you, that there's usually someone who can point you in the right direction. Mm-hmm. I love that it's such a diverse group, age-wise too, from young to old. Previous groups I've been in, it's like you were a youngster if you were 50. And so it's great to have the young people.
It seemed to me very inclusive. And mm-hmm. one thing I noticed from going this morning was the level of uniqueness to each one person to the other and creativity. Except for maybe one or two knitters like me, was following a pattern. Everybody was right. doing their own thing. It sprang from their mind and their heart and their soul. And it was quite something to see. You got the sense that everybody was an artist in their own right.
Yeah. Well, a lot of us will follow a pattern at some time, but the group is kind of also an encouragement to just go rogue and do what you feel like it. We very much encourage rule breaking. You know, if you're doing a quilt and you don't like it, do what you want. You know,
do what you want. Well, this leads me to this question, which I think is an important one. There are many, and I know there are many, Creative Maine listeners who are feeling stressed and helpless by the chaos of the world as we have it now. And what would your advice be to those who don't know what they can do about things? Is craftivism a potential outlet for someone who doesn't usually have what's deemed a crafting skill? Can you use the work of your hands to express your feelings, even if you're not an accomplished quilter or weaver or embroideress or what have you?
I think so. I don't think you have to be accomplished at anything to enjoy it. You can knit like I do, which is not well, and still have something to show for it and feel good about. Mm-hmm. Craft is a form, I think, of meditation, because it helps you to focus on what you're doing and kind of takes you away from everything else, or to even just go deeper in thinking about what's going on, just a way to sit with things.
And find community too.
Yes, and to find community. If you find a knit group, you can sit and then they can help you learn.
There was one young lady at the group this morning and she had one of those little round looms that you can buy at Michael's. I don't think it takes any special skill to learn how to do that, but she said, I come here for the community.
Yes. Yeah. I think there was one lady who came in and she says, well, I don't really craft, but I really wanted to see what you're doing in here. And she says, I'm taking a life drawing class down the hall. Is it okay if I sit here and just draw you guys? And
well, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure crafting is necessarily a rule in our group. Really, it's just an excuse.
It's yeah.
But crafting is just something that brings people together and
it allows you to express what's in your heart.
Yes.
So where can Creative Maine listeners find Stitch Social? How do you come? How do you get introduced to the gang? What do you do?
Well, it's every second and fourth Saturday of the month. It's at 9:30 to 11. It's in the Waterfall Arts Building in Belfast, Maine. And you just bring something to do. Or if you have nothing that you're working on, bring something to show off. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just to ask the receptionist in the front where we're at. It's anybody can come. There's we come from all over, towns spread out. I think somebody today said they came from Augusta.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad that you could come and talk about this with me, and keep on keeping on, you know, do your thing and put your message on your back, and it will affect someone. It'll change someone.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you today.
Thank you.
I'm in Belfast at Waterfall Arts, which is a wonderful art collective, art school, wonderful meeting place for like-minded folks who like to participate and learn different arts. And I'm talking with Amy Tingle, who's the program director here at Waterfall Arts. And she runs an incredible program two Saturday mornings a month called Stitch Social. And people are very creative. They come, they do all kinds of crafts. And they're a very socially minded group in addition to people who are looking for community and craft. So tell us, Amy, a little bit about Stitch Social and your role in it.
Sure. Stitch Social started 3 years ago after a visit to Waterfall Arts by the craftivist, Shannon Downey, who's out of Chicago. She goes by Badass Cross Stitch online. And she really inspired the group to start. We exhibited her artwork, three of her craft stitch projects, and then she taught two embroidery workshops. And after that, we decided we needed to start our own embroidery group, I guess is sort of where we started. We thought the folks who had been in those workshops wanted to continue meeting, and then it grew from there into any kind of fiber arts. And so we've been meeting for 3 years.
That's amazing. So there is a number of people I noticed who are doing crafts that extend their voice and their messages through that craft. So what are you doing? I noticed you doing some very interesting embroidery next door.
I do. I have a project that I call Power Lines, and I embroider lines from poems or other kinds of writing onto felt, and then I mount them on a more colorful piece of fabric, and I post them around town. So it's a form of guerrilla art, and I call it power lines because I think they're powerful lines on power lines.
That's great. That's great. What is your basic message, would you say, through these stitches?
It depends. I just posted, well, the one I'm working on right now is by an author named Yi Yun Lee, and she wrote a book called Things in Nature Merely Grow, and I loved that title. It's a beautiful, beautiful book about losing her son, but I just thought it was such a beautiful line, so that's the one I posted. But I also, a couple weeks ago, posted the words of Renee Good, I'm Not Mad at You, and that one's out downtown right now. So the message changes, just depends on what I'm feeling or what I feel like is important or imperative. It's usually a message that I want people to kind of stop for a minute and take in and either make them think or make them feel something.
Yes, it's simple but powerful.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations on a wonderful group and a great initiative. What's ahead for you? What are you looking at for your own crafting in the future?
Well, I had a show of my work in December at Anodyne Bookshop in Searsport, yeah. And I'm continuing. That's a long, probably it'll end up being a sort of a lifelong project that I'm working on, but I had a couple of fabric books in that show, so I'm making some more fabric books, and I'll be teaching out at Haystack in May. So,
What are you teaching at Haystack?
Narrative embroidery. So almost everything I ever make has some kind of words in it. So I'm always stitching words into my work in different ways. So I just think narrative makes sense in the work that I do. And
especially now.
Yeah, especially now. Words are important.
Words can be powerful.
Yes.
So here at the Stitch Social gathering at Waterfall Arts, I have a new friend. Her name is Grace. and she does some wonderful artwork that is socially conscious and evokes emotional feelings and talks about history a little bit and civil rights. So I'm going to ask Grace, what do you do and how do you extend your voice through your craft?
Yeah, extending my voice just reminds me of expression. And I think my primary use of my craft is to try to connect intuitively with myself, take a connection to myself, or really tapping into what I'm feeling or experiencing, and letting that come out through my hands, and really removing a lot of like critical thinking around what that needs to look like. Mm-hmm.
What is your medium, by and large?
So I've, for a long time, dabbled in multimedia, more oriented towards like 2D paper collage. And in the last 5 years, I've brought in textile. I revisited embroidery, which I learned as a, like, I learned cross-stitching as a child, like that there was a right way to do it.
Right.
And there is a right way to do a cross-stitch pattern. There's a right way to like send a, make a clear visual and follow a pattern through cross-stitch. But I started integrating all different types of embroidery stitches and fabrics that people had given me or that I'd found at a thrift store or that I'd like clipped from something, like a small piece of something that I didn't want the whole piece of fabric, but I really liked that one little image, and just integrating it into more of a stitch collage. But I've also used poster printmaking on fabric as a starting point, and then stitched and collaged off of that. And a lot of times the words that are on those posters are derived from what I'm sitting with in terms of the experience or response to what I'm having with what's going on socially and politically in the United States. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So this is mostly for you to process, or do you do this for other people to look and feel as well?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's just a really satisfying process, and I think, like, some of the words give it meaning. I often, like, really remember, like, where I got a button or thread or fabric from, so I'm kind of, like, sitting with the friend or the experience that I received and I'm integrating it into this whole picture. I did start to share some things that were in a more finished state in different local community art shows, primarily at Waterfall Arts, but there's also one that Stitch Social. We did a collaborative work where I embroidered a Free Palestine print, and it's a part of a larger piece that's at the Reversing Falls Sanctuary in Brooksville, I think.
Yeah.
So I've started to dabble in sharing it. I also created some patches with language related to, you know, anti-ICE, and addressing, like, some words related to addressing immigration enforcement, and donated them to a fundraiser that happened recently. So those are out in the world. I don't know who bought them, and I'm excited to see if they show up on somebody's jacket or bag or, so those are some ways it's going out there. And I like to give them away or trade with friends and people I know. There's a long history of craftivism in domestic arts. I'll just use the phrase domestic arts, but...
Sure.
What humanity is experiencing currently is really challenging and really has, I feel like there's a huge sense of injustice that most people are navigating, myself included. And so, like, sitting with that hand and then, like, having it expressed through visual art, through crafts, yeah, and sewing, to me feels like some powerful reclamation. And I feel grateful to be able to be more, like, authentically expressive with what I believe through my art in a way that people a few generations ago, in my experience, were not able to be as clear.
I'm here with Jackie, another friend from Stitch Social, and Jackie does a lot of sewing with upcycled materials, and I was asking her what she does and what is the underlying impetus or purpose or wish for it.
Oh, I guess you can rescue just about anything, any object, and give it a second
life.
purposed existence, yes. And I'm very much in love with that. And I also, we are barraged with all kinds of junk packaging, junk mail, and things like that. And it can always be transformed. There's something really interesting in just about anything that you pick up, if you look at it carefully. That's what motivates me. And I love the feel of some of these things. The brown paper excites me.
Okay.
I don't know why. But I've done a lot of things with brown paper, how to transform it, or just use it just to draw, or a momentary sketch.
Do you collage? Do you sew? What are you doing with all this wonderful stuff?
I do. I do a lot of visible mending. And then it might turn into a blanket, a quilt, or just a pair of pants that you don't have to give up right away, that's become old and comfortable. I don't know what else to say. It gives me a great satisfaction that it's not something that's going to these terrible dumping sites that we have everywhere. Appleton is very conscious about things like that. And the man that runs a recycle facility in, it's on Route 17, but he's also running the facility to facilitate upcycling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he saves things that could be valuable to other people. It's really extraordinary. There's a definite movement around here that we're drowning in all this stuff that we consider disposable and that we can
reuse. So your message to the world is this is all perfectly wonderful stuff and we can reuse it and give it new life and keep it out of the waste stream.
I believe you can.
I'm here in Belfast, Maine, with Jackie Otino, who is the proprietor of Heavenly Yarns, right in downtown Belfast. And I wanted to talk to Jackie about the whole red hat phenomenon. What did you notice? What happened in advance of and during the whole red hat craze?
Hi, Dina. Always so good to see you.
Thank you.
The red hat phenomenon, I would say when I first realized that it was a thing, well, the first thing I did was I kind of gathered up all the brands of red yarn that we had and I put them in a nice basket and had them available for people. And that was, in the first couple of days, just drained. And I simultaneously got a hold of all of my distributors and placed orders for more red yarn. And that started rolling in. Some of it was out of stock already because I'm not the only yarn store who had that idea. I just got in as much red yarn as I could, and we sold it all, hundreds of skeins of yarn.
Wow.
And people would come in, and sometimes they were a little shy because, you know, just of the nature of the beast. And we just said, like, it's cool. We've got you. We're here for you. We're in this together. We're doing this. And, yeah, it's still flowing. We still are moving through quite a bit of red yarn.
That's amazing. What is it? What do you think the appeal is, aside from people wanting to help? I don't know. One of the things that I feel is people are absolutely unprepared for what's going on, and they want to do something with a capital D and a capital S, and they don't know what that might be. So this is, in a sense, I'm calling it extending your voice through your craft.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way to put it. I think one thing that is appealing is that the proceeds from the pattern sales directly benefited the citizens of Minneapolis, and I believe they've raised like $750, close to $1 million.
Wow.
Just in $5 patterns. And we would have people come in that either had already made the hat or weren't planning to make it, but they wanted to make an impact. And so they would buy two or three patterns just to make a donation. And sometimes we would print them off and give them to people who, you know, maybe didn't have a spare $5, but they wanted to make the hat or whatever, but mm-hmm. we've through the shop sales, we've probably sold at least 100, if not more. What do you think, Sarah? Patterns? At least 100.
100 patterns or 100 skeins?
Well over 100 skeins, but at least 100 patterns.
1,000 skeins. Wow.
But back to your question, I think that, like, you know, knitting has a very political history, and, you know, knitters are not a sit back and take it kind of bunch. And so this is appealing, I think, you know? They're making a donation with the pattern sales, and they're making a visible impact by, you know, wearing the hat and making more hats to either sell or donate and mm-hmm. give them to their friends that don't knit. A lot of people have made many a hat, you know, 4, 5, 6 hats that they give to people.
That's amazing. I was just at a gathering where someone had knitted a melt the ice hat and then had embroidered a patch to go on it in addition. So people are definitely making it their own.
Yeah, they are. And I've also had people making like a little pin, like a tiny red hat that's a pin that they're wearing on their lapels.
So it's really become somewhat enduring symbol and very recognizable.
Right, exactly, yeah.
I understand there's an event coming up in Belfast on March 28th in conjunction with the No Kings Rally, and it's a knit-in.
Yeah, a knit-a-thon. Sarah Brandnew hosts a biannual, twice a year. She has a knit-a-thon. It happens from 8 in the morning till 8 at night at St. Margaret's Church in Belfast, and it always benefits something local in the area, and this one is going towards the
Mid-Coast Maine Homeless Coalition. Very good. So if you are in the Belfast area and you knit, come by St. Margaret's. St. Margaret's, and do some knitting, and we figure a lot of people are going to be knitting on red hats, and why not? And do some good for our community. 1 to 3 is the No Kings Rally. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to my inspiring guests, Vic Mazza, Connie Whitaker, Amy Tingle, Jackie Otino, and the voices of Stitch Social, Grace and Jackie. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ariel Chapman. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on weru.org for another eclectic episode on Thursday, April 16th at 4 p.m., when we will discuss being a writer in Maine. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson, wishing you a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.